Well, this is Arthur Stan back here at Radio Liberty, coming to from the hills overlooking beautiful and picturesque Monterey Bay, and bringing you the news behind the news, the story behind the story, hoping to convince you that reality is usually scoffed at. Illusion is usually king. But in the battle for survival of Western civilization, it's going to be reality, not illusion or delusion, that's going to determine what the future will bring. And I need to remind you the views that are expressed here are not necessarily those of the owners, management, staff, sponsors, or supporters of the station you're listening to. They happen to be my views, the views of our guests. And we welcome your calls from out across America at 1-888-24-LIBERTY, that's 1-888-24-LIBERTY, or 464-8295. But please hold your calls for the time being, because, of course, we hope we're going to have Will Thomas on with us. And Will's an old friend, a writer. He's written on a number of subjects, on the Gulf War illness and on chemtrails. But he's come up with a new book on what really happened on 9-1-1, and hopefully he's going to be with us in just a few minutes. But, you know, if you really read the 9-1-1 Commission testimony, you realize that Condoleezza Rice was simply lying to the 9-1-1 Commission. She lied to the American people. Well, she said, I mean, who could have thought that they would take a plane and crash it into the Pentagon of the World Trade Center? And she knew that they'd been holding military exercises for really months about that. And if you read her testimony before the 9-1-1 Commission, why, of course, one of the people there, Ben Venisti, I think was his name, and when she got there, he had the first opportunity to ask her, after you read the presidential daily directive, or President TBD, Presidency Daily Briefing of August 6th, did you tell the president? Well, you know, if you read, of course, what was said, you could tell she kept interrupting him and going off into a different subject, because she did not want the American people to know that she and the president had talked about the fact that the Bin Laden, according to the brief, was determined to attack America, and the brief dealt with hijacking in several places. And, of course, poor old Ben Venisti was trying to get her to say, did you talk to the president or not? Just give me a yes or no answer. And she spent, you know, all the time. Now, he only had maybe 5 minutes at the most to ask her questions, because everybody was supposed to be able to ask questions, and she simply ran out the time so she wouldn't have to answer the question. She's not an honest individual, and she, along with, of course, all the others, high government officials, knew the terrorist attack was coming and lied about it. George Tenet is, and you'll find this in the book State of Siege by Bob Woodward. Bob Tenet said that he talked to her, I believe it was on the 10th of July of 2001, and told her there was going to be an imminent attack. And Condoleezza Rice just doesn't remember that talk at all. And Richard Clark said he repeatedly briefed Condoleezza Rice about the danger of an imminent attack. And she looked so innocent there with a sweet little face and says, well, I don't remember being told that. She's not telling the truth. And when immediately after the 9-1-1 attack, she held a press conference and she told the American people, who could ever have imagined that they would hijack planes and crash them into buildings? She was just plain lying. Now, if she was lying about that, you can assume she's lying about everything, because we've established she's a liar. But then so are they all. I mean, certainly the acting secretary of the FBI testified under oath that he had told John Ashcroft about the threat of an imminent attack. And John Ashcroft had said, I don't want to hear any more about a terrorist attack. And then John Ashcroft tells the 9-1-1 Commission, I never said that. So obviously somebody's lying. And if you go through the testimony and you go through the book without precedent, you'll find that everybody is lying. The military is lying. The FAA is lying. There's no way that these things could have happened the way we were told. But the big thing that nobody wants to talk about, and which Will covers in his book, is the 9-1-1 tapes that show there were hijackings going on that morning, part of a military exercise, of one time. There were 29 hijackings that morning, at least appeared to be, all designed to confuse the FAA controllers. Well, this is Dr. Stan here at Radio Liberty, coming to you from the hills overlooking beautiful and picturesque Monterey Bay, or that today we're to have a guest, Mr. Will Thomas, who's written a new book about 911, and I was simply talking about what we do know about what happened that morning that has been concealed from the American people. And you have to ask why the government would intentionally lie to the American people about what happened that morning. Well, one of the things that happened that morning is that there were actually military exercises that were simulating hijackings. Yes, military exercises that were simulating hijackings of planes, and that had many similar exercises within the preceding weeks and months of simulating planes being hijacked here in the United States and crashed into buildings. Well, on the morning of September 11th, they had similar exercises, and when they actually simulated crashing the planes into buildings, I can't be absolutely certain, but I can be absolutely certain that that information was withheld from the American people. Why? Well, because certainly I don't think anybody's gullible enough to believe that Osama bin Laden over in a cave in Pakistan had sophisticated equipment that they could implant on the radar screens of the FAA and of NORAD, you know, simulated images of planes flying. There at one time, according to an article, and you can read it in the September issue of Vanity Fair magazine, there were 29 simulated hijackings that morning. Which ones were real and which ones weren't, they couldn't figure out. Now, why have they withheld the information from the American people? They're at NORAD headquarters in New England. Why, after Flight 11, American Flight 11 had crashed into the North Tower, the images appeared on the radar screen and the transponder, which had come back on, that Flight 11, which had crashed into the North Tower, was now flying south towards Washington, D.C. How could that be? Well, of course, it couldn't be. I mean, you can't crash into a building and have the plane incinerated and still be flying, but somebody was planting those images there to confuse the issue, and this obviously was an intelligence operation designed to confuse the people at NORAD, designed to confuse the FAA flight controllers. And then, of course, the other thing which nobody wants to talk about, and that is the fact that they changed the line of command. Ordinarily, of course, you didn't even have to go through anybody. The FAA, if there was somebody, a plane was hijacked, the FAA would immediately notify NORAD, and NORAD then would go ahead and dispatch the planes to intercept it. But just before 911, they changed the rules, and we'll be right back. Well, this is Dr. Stan, and our guest today is Will Thomas, and Will's been studying what really happened on 911. So, Will, I'm so glad to have you with us today. Having a little trouble with weather up there?
We've had quite a bit of problems with weather, Dr. Stan. We've had power. I've had no electricity for basically 3 weeks. Just got it back yesterday, and it's been quite a time here. Trees down, power lines down, and now we're looking toward flooding, I guess, as this snow starts to melt.
How much snow do you have?
We got about a foot here, but we're not used to it. and a lot of ice, and just many trees and power lines down. It's and many windstorms over the past short while.
All right.
So I'm just back to my place right now, in fact.
All right, fine. Well, I appreciate so much you being with us. Anyway, Will has written a new book on what happened on 911, where he has the complete a transcript of the 911 tapes. My understanding, is that right?
Yes, I was very lucky to get the transcript from Flight 93. This is a cockpit voice recorder, Dr. Stan, and we have it up until the final 2 minutes, at which point the aircraft was shot down, and that last 2 minutes was censored. But we do have the tape of what happened in the cockpit and nearby. And I also, just before the book went to press, got my hands on the NEADS, the Northeast Air Defense Sector tapes, detailing and recording the U.S. air defense response to the air attacks of 9/11. So very, very lucky to get my hands on those tapes.
All right, fine. Well, of course, I haven't got my copy of the book yet, but I'm sure it's going to be coming here. How soon will they be available?
I believe we'll have the book available next week. I have to talk to my publisher, George Green, out in Idaho, but as far as I know, we're on track to actually have copies in hand next week, and that book will be going up for sale on my website, willthomas.com. TransCriptNet, and I'll make sure that you get some copies as well.
All right. Well, we'll appreciate it. Well, let's tell our listeners what your conclusion is. Of course, you know, what the government wants us to believe is that, you know, 19 Islamic hijackers came to America, and they were so much smarter than the FBI and the CIA and all of our other 12 intelligence agencies, because we've got 14 intelligence agencies, and nobody had any idea they were here, and nobody had any idea there was going to be an attack. And then that morning, of course, they hijacked 4 planes, and somehow or other they just managed to time this right along, of course, with these military exercises that simulated somebody hijacking planes. And so there were all sorts of false images there on the screens. And then, of course, the whole system between NORAD and FAA broke down. And of course, nobody knew who was really in charge. And, I mean, the story is so amazing because they knew the attack was coming. Obviously, all sorts of preparations had been made. You know, even the planes, they were supposed to be launched from Andrews Air Force Base to protect America. And they were the highest possible alert. And, oh, shucks, they just didn't have any weapons. They had to carry them across the airfield. It took them a half an hour to carry the weapons to get onto those planes at Andrews Air Force Base. And, I mean, this story is so incredible. You wonder if anybody could really believe this. I mean, we are the most sophisticated military in the world. And, oh, shucks, knowing an attack is coming, why we couldn't even get one plane in the air to shoot down one of the aircraft that was threatening our nation.
Well, you pretty well cover it.
And all right. Well,
it's nonsensical on the face of it. Now, my book is called Day of Deception, Ground Zero and Beyond, and it takes us from that day, minute by minute, fully documented. I have 1,000 footnotes in this book, Dr. Stan, so we're fully documented through that day up until October 2006. So this actually puts everything in context, which many 9/11 books I've found haven't been able to do, is put it in context. And Day of Deception is deliberately taken from the book titled Day of Deceit, a book you might know by Lieutenant Commander Robert Stinnett of the U.S. Navy, who, after years of research and several boxcars of declassified military documents, detailed the Pearl Harbor scam, is the only word, where, again, the attacks were provoked, were noted. The commanders in charge of the Navy and Army Air Force in Pearl Harbor were not notified, and, of course, the attacks went ahead. And interestingly, Dr. Stan, about the same number of Americans died, although these were uniformed Americans. About 3,000 died at Pearl Harbor number 1, and approximately 3,000 people, mostly civilians, died Pearl Harbor number 2. But this book, Day of Deception, draws many parallels. In fact, it opens with the attack on Pearl Harbor. Both of these attacks were known in advance and were facilitated by the White House in order to further their aims, in both cases, to get a reluctant American populace behind a war that would further profits and control of the moneyed elite.
Well, because I think the biggest thing is to get us so fearful that we will be willing to accept a dictatorship in America, a military dictatorship, and how they passed the legislation, the Military Commissions Act, and the John Warner National Defense Appropriations Act. I mean, even Liberal Senator Patrick Leahy of Vermont has said this, certainly encourages the president to declare martial law. And we know there's no real danger here in America of terrorism, because it's been over 5 years since 9/11, not one major terrorist attack. Our borders are open. They have a catch-and-release program for Islamic militants that they catch sneaking into the country. They catch them, and then they let them go. There are not air marshals on less than 10% of our planes. Our pilots are not armed because they've made it so ridiculous that it's just totally frustrating for the pilots to even to carry a weapon today. Because of government regulations, they don't bother to check into the cargo that goes into the hold at all. If anybody wanted to blow up a plane, they could do it very easily. But they're using, of course, what happened on 9/11 to justify, in case of a national emergency, which the president can call at any time, a military dictatorship with military commissions, and the use of the military, National Guard, and our own troops against the American people by repealing the Posse-Comitatus Act. And the American people are going along because we're so fearful of the wicked Osama bin Laden who's living in a cave.
What makes me very angry as an American and as a journalist who has covered this story, I wrote the first book, the first documented book on 9/11 called All Fall Down, The Politics of Terror and Mass Persuasion. And my publisher, whom I mentioned, George Green, asked me to update that book some 5 years later. And, of course, I had to call him back and say, I can't just update it. There's so much new information. I have to write a completely new book, which I have done. And in so doing, in writing two books on 9/11, I have documented conclusively that the FBI in particular, John O'Neill by name and his anti-terrorist task force, were on it. They were checking these students at the American flight schools. They were raising the alarms about Islamic terrorists flying aircraft into American buildings, including the World Trade Center, which they named. They were on it. We know that the CIA was recording Osama bin Laden's phone calls and boasting to Congress that they could do so in order to keep their funding. They said that they were tracking al-Qaeda cells in the United States of America for years. They, as you alluded to, they allowed these terrorists into the United States and let them roam freely, buy airplane tickets. They got traffic tickets. They weren't hauled in. The CIA, and particularly the FBI, were on it. They were doing their jobs, and they were repeatedly blocked by their superiors from investigating people like Mr. Massawi, who you recall they caught trying to learn how to turn and bank heavy airliners up in Minnesota, and an alert flight instructor called the FBI and said, this guy doesn't want to know how to land or take off. He just wants to know how to maneuver this aircraft. They caught him with logbooks in his car. They had a laptop. Who knows what's on the laptop? We don't know it because John Ashcroft, the attorney general, refused permission from the FBI agents to open that laptop and ascertain its contents, its files, its directories. He even forbid them to interrogate Massawi until after 9/11. And yet, after 9/11, we have these draconian Patriot Act, so-called 1 and 2, a third is in the works, as you rightly called it, the foundations of a police state, and that we are told that this is for our own protection. You know, Dr. Stan, I have people in my family telling me that this is basically a good thing, that America loses its freedoms, we lose our Constitution, our Bill of Rights, because it's for our own protection and safety to catch these evil terrorists, who, of course, we all know were funded by the CIA in the first place in Afghanistan. The point is the system worked. These people were tracked. They were identified. We have an Operation Able Danger, very interesting. The U.S. Navy and other military people were involved in using special algorithms in computers to track repeated words, keywords, and they put their finger on Muhammad Atta.
I knew who he was, right.
Yeah, they had Atta tracked, what is it now, 2 years in advance?
Right.
They were on it.
And, of course, the most interesting thing, of course, is the book that was written by Tom Keene and Lee Hamilton, where they talk about the Able Danger, and they said, well, this only one military officer had talked about it, and he obviously was mistaken. And the truth of the matter, there were five military officers, and all of them risked their careers, and they will never get another promotion in the military,
right,
by coming forward and talking about Able Danger. They didn't want the American people to know that. And, of course, I'm sure that Tom Keene and Lee Hamilton knew that, but as well, when they wrote in the book there was one military officer, what about the other four military officers? They figured the average American is too dumb to have done the study to realize there were five military officers who talked about it. So why would they try to deceive us? Very simply because everything is deception and everything is deceit. Because imagine the implications if they knew the attack was coming and they left those Americans there in the World Trade Center and, of course, in the Pentagon, to die. Well, we'll go right ahead.
Okay.
Go right ahead.
Well, we have a station break.
Well, we do, but...
Well, it's the only proper word for it is treason. The military officer who came forward, of course, went to the 9/11 Commission, Mr. Keene, as you just mentioned. Not a mention of it in the 9/11 cover-up. We should call it the 9/11 cover-up, or the 9/11 omission, as some people term that book. But the only possible word is treason. You asked me at the beginning of this show, off the top of the program, what my conclusion was, and my conclusion, of course, the same as yourself. And, you know, the majority of Americans do not trust the story they were given about September 11th. The polls are up in the 80 percentile range. Many suspect the worst, and we can say definitively, looking at the documented evidence, that treason was committed at the highest levels of the U.S. government and military. And that's the other striking thing in Day of Deception. This is a book that has quite a bit of flying in it because, of course, these were aerial attacks, and the defenders would have to respond with the U.S. Air Force. And as a former member of the U.S. military, as a former pilot, I felt qualified to write on these matters. And the book shows conclusively, as we all know by now, not only were the first fighters launched late from distant bases in Cape Cod, they were ordered to fly a subsonic, that is below the speed of sound, at a fraction of their top speeds, and arrived in New York, over New York City, too late to intercept either Flight 11, which was hitting the North Tower as they lifted off the runway at Cape Cod, or Flight 175, which they could have intercepted over the Hudson River if they had been allowed to fly flat out at some 1,600 miles per hour, and if they were not directed, Dr. Stan, to a military exercise area and off the Atlantic coast in order to circle over the empty ocean.
In fact, what was so funny is they took off from Langley, which is 100 miles away from from Washington, D.C., and at the time the plane struck the Pentagon,
yes.
And I don't want to get into that, but at that time that the plane struck the Pentagon, they were 150 miles away from Washington, D.C. How could they be further away than when they took off?
Because they were sent in the opposite direction.
I mean, how could that be done unintentionally? And nobody wants to ask that question. But what I want to know is what happened to the planes that were at Andrews Air Force Base,
yes.
Within 10 miles of the Capitol.
Yes.
And they had two squadrons of planes there,
yes.
On the ready to defend our nation's capital. We are on the highest alert. What happened to those planes?
Well, we'll tell you what happened to those planes. They vanished into cyberspace. On September 10th, those two squadrons, one Marine, one Air Force, were mentioned very proudly and rightly so, as defenders of the Capitol, as you just stated. Guess what? On the morning of December 12th, those squadrons no longer existed, at least not on the official Andrews Air Force Base website, which was just a transport squadron and, of course, the home of Air Force One, of the presidential Air Force One. And isn't it curious, Dr. Stan, that when the so-called, I can't call him president, it sticks in my throat, the selected president of the United States finally lifted off from Sarasota Airport in Florida. After wandering around, they got lost. The motorcade got lost. Reminds me of Princess Di, I remarked in the book, who was still alive when they picked her up in the ambulance, but the ambulance got lost on the way to the hospital, and she died en route. Well, the president's motorcade got lost.
Hold that. Though. We'll be right back with you, Will, in just a moment here.
Very good.
At Radio Liberty. Well, this is Dr. Stan here. Our guest this morning is Will Thomas. I should say this afternoon, we're talking about his new book, and he's really done a lot of research on this. And, of course, what most people don't understand is, and they've never asked the questions, why, with the most sophisticated Air Force in the whole world, couldn't we get at least one plane, to shoot down at least one airliner? They had plenty of time to do it, but the planes at Langley Air Force Base, which is 100 miles away, the fighter planes were not shipped to Washington, D.C. to protect Washington, D.C. They were sent out over the Atlantic Ocean. And so they started out 100 miles away from Washington, D.C. And at the time that whatever struck the Pentagon struck it, they were 150 miles away from Washington, D.C. How could that have happened? And then the other question I asked is, what happened to the planes at Andrews Air Force Base, which was only 10 miles away from Washington, D.C.? They were needed to be ready to defend our nation's capital, fully armed, ready. But what happened to them that morning, Will? And just give that answer once again.
Yes, exactly. The aircraft were deliberately sent in the opposite direction from the Pentagon. They were sent out over the Atlantic Ocean. And again, very, very important, and held to speeds of around 475 miles per hour. Those aircraft were capable of speeds in excess of 1,600 miles per hour, and they were deliberately told to fly slow, and they were sent in the wrong direction. And I must say that the NEADS tapes, the Northeastern Air Defense Sector, responsible for defending the most critical area, the heartland of the United States, did a superb job. They did the best they could monitoring their radars, trying to get airplanes scrambled, and what happened to them was there were four air defense drills taking place at the same time, as you said off the top of the show, some of them including live simulated hijacked aircraft, actual airliners that were simulating hijackings, and guess what? One of them was called Flight 11. And after Flight 11 impacted the North Tower of the World Trade Center, U.S. Air Force personnel were tracking a Phantom Flight 11, and the air traffic controllers themselves were in great confusion. Did this plane crash, or was it still in the air? And they were chasing up to two dozen ghost echoes on their radar scopes from implanted tracks of bogus aircraft meant for the air defense drills that had meanwhile drawn off the bulk of U.S. air defense fighter planes north into Alaska, looking out over the North Pole, far from the northeastern seaboard where the actual attacks were taking place.
Yeah, I think that some of Bin Laden's sure smart to have arranged it for that very morning when you've got four different exercises going. He must be an awful smart terrorist. And then, of course, the question I've heard asked and answered, and I wonder your thought on it, that the planes at Andrews Air Force Base, which were there to guard our nation's capital, were flown off someplace east or west, you know, in these exercises, so there was no defense for the nation's capital. But they can't tell the American people that because they don't want them to know about those exercises because they might suspect that they've been lied to, and those people were left there to die like Pearl Harbor all over again.
That's correct, and we owe some debt of gratitude to Michael Rupert, the ex-LAPD police officer who wrote about crossing the Rubicon, as you're well aware. And it was Michael Rupert who found out through his investigations that it was Osama von Rumsfeld, in other words, Donald Rumsfeld, Secretary of Defense, who arranged those exercises and moved others from other dates on other months to September 11th and coordinated all of those exercises. I mentioned four air defense drills. There were bioterrorist drills. There were simulated airplane crashes into the Pentagon, into the NSA, National Security Agency, that morning. It was Donald Rumsfeld who put all of those attacks together on the same day, and for his painstaking investigations, the last I heard, Michael Rupert had to flee the United States in the face of official death threats and is now apparently living in Venezuela after fingering Donald Rumsfeld. And of course, we want to hear from Dick Cheney, where was he during this? Where was Mr. Rumsfeld during this? Why was the acting head of the Joint Chiefs of Staff in a routine meeting and left undisturbed throughout the attacks on his own country? Those questions were never asked in the Senate investigating hearings nor by the 9/11 Commission.
Okay. Both of those commissions were headed by people who come from the Council on Foreign Relations, and of course both of them were not to reveal what happened, but to conceal what happened, and they did a good job of it. And of course both of the reports were censored by the Bush administration before they were released so that Osama bin Laden would not learn what we knew about the attacks beforehand. And there are people who really believe that. Well, this is Dr. Stan back here. Of course, our guest this morning is William Thomas. And there's only really two major questions. That is, did they know the attack was coming and allow it to happen? Or did they know that this whole thing was feigned? And those buildings, certainly there's no question in my mind that Building 7 was brought down by internal explosives. And if that is the case, then perhaps the other buildings were brought down by explosives. And everything we've been told is a lie. What's your final take on it, Will?
Absolutely. We know from the firefighters who I document in Day of Deception, as well as many eyewitness accounts, as well as media accounts that put out the first reports live at the time, and of course were later censored, that there were definitely bombs in the buildings. We're talking the World Trade Center's towers 1 and 2. You're right about Building 7. Even Mayor Giuliani later admitted on tape that that building was pulled, which is the word used by demolition experts when they pull a building down or demolish it. What's interesting, and Barry Zwicker, whom I had the pleasure of meeting, he was out here on a speaking tour, he's written a book called Towers of Deception, and he pointed out, Dr. Stan, that you can't just run into a burning building and plant bombs and bring it straight down in a perfect demolition. In fact, those bombs would have to have been in place, Barry Zwicker wrote, at least 2 weeks in advance, which puts us in a whole new realm of, well, we have to use the word, I'm afraid, conspiracy here. Because those bombs were planted in advance. We know there were thermite or thermate bombs in the basements of Buildings 1 and 2 WTC. We know that because we have satellite sensors showing hot spots in excess of some 1,200 degrees centigrade, if I have that right here, 2 weeks after those buildings were down and the fires were supposedly put out. Those hot spots remained, and the only thing we know capable of doing that is thermate, which would have burned through those girders like a hot knife through butter and allowed those buildings to fall straight down. And then we see in slow motion videotape available on the internet what looked like squibs, another demolition term for the explosive charges, blowing out the floor joists in the floors below the pancaking floors. In other words, as the floors came down through the centers of the buildings, we see squibs blowing out below them, weakening the floors as they fell, because each floor weighed some 2 million pounds.
Hold on, sir. We're going to be right back in just here with a moment with Will Thomas. Well, this is Dr. Stan. Our guest today is Will Thomas, and Will has written a book on what really happened on 9-1-1. You've been lied to. And, of course, Condoleezza Rice repeatedly lied. And I hope any of you who would like to get more information, go to our website and pull down my August and September and October newsletters. You need to read them. You need to understand that those people were left in the buildings to die. But how else were you going to get the American people to be willing to go to war with Afghanistan? I mean, to catch the wicked Osama bin Laden. And then we forgot about Osama bin Laden. We went to war with Iraq, and how many hundreds of thousands of people have died in Iraq? We don't know, but an awful lot of people have died. And, of course, increasing hatred towards America. This is what really is so concerning, because obviously our leaders and the people who are working behind the scenes are intent upon taking us to war with the Muslim world. And there are so many books out telling us how terrible the Muslims are. And, of course, they're doing everything they can to get the Muslims to hate us and to get us to hate the Muslims. We have to go back to 9-1-1, and that's why Will's book is so important. Well, Will Thomas was simply saying that if you look at the pictures up on the Internet of Building 7 coming down, and you can go up there on the Internet and type in Google Building 7 video, and you'll see the building coming down. It's obvious this is a controlled demolition. So why don't you develop that idea, and then what we know about the Twin Towers? Certainly, there's even been people who were in the basement at the time of the attack who heard the explosion in the basement before the plane hit the building. Do you want to cover that?
Well, they were severely, many of these were engineers, maintenance workers in the basements who were badly burned and very badly injured by explosions. So it's not just their verbal testimony, their physical testimony, if you will. They were critically injured by violent explosions just before the planes hit high above in the buildings. And interestingly, when the fire responders entered the lobbies of Building 1 and 2 with that French film crew, you recall, that were filming just down the street, and they happened to be on the scene, everyone remarked that the lobbies of those buildings looked like a bomb had gone off, and they didn't understand how the demolition had occurred in those lobbies because the elevators did not connect to the upper floors where the aircraft actually hit. We were told that the flaming fuel jumped down the elevator shafts and blew out the lobbies. Well, the elevators don't connect. There are things called sky lobbies up on the 77th, 78th floor where you have to transfer elevators from the upper parts of these buildings to the lower half. So while some fuel could get down some heating ducts, there's no possibility that any kind of fuel detonated those lobbies and gave that extensive destruction found by the firefighters and film crews.
And, of course, we saw, of course, when the second plane that was flight 175, United right. 175, hit the South Tower, you saw most of the fuel just exploded outside the building.
That's right. It almost missed the building. It clipped the corner of the building. The fires, of course, were not intense. We have Chief Palmer and others, Chief Buka up there, radioing calmly. We actually have the radio tapes. You know, we need some more hoses up here. We have many injured. They're using coded numbers to denote this over the open air. But the basic message was everything's under control. Office workers stayed behind Dr. Stan to fight the fires. They felt, you know, there was no immediate danger to the building, certainly, and that we have structural engineers that have come out publicly stating emphatically that fuel fires, that is, jet fuel fires, do not burn hot enough to melt or even weaken structural-grade steel. There's zero possibility this happened in those buildings. And the problem is, at least from the terrorist point of view, and I'm including the White House in that statement, you have to get those upper floors moving, and then at 2 million pounds per floor, once they start moving, it will pancake the building. The only way to get those upper floors moving is to blow the joists with explosives. Isn't it fascinating that a week before 9/11 in the North Tower, we know that, much of the building was, the electrical and security systems were turned off so they could run fiber optic power cable through the building. And many people were seen wandering through the building with clipboards and uniforms who no one had ever seen before. And, of course, fiber optics are data cables, not electrical cables, have nothing to do with power whatsoever. And what is interesting also is that many of these very high-performance financial firms had to shut down their computers, a very laborious process, and had to back up their files. And this is key. All of the books of 9/11 that I have looked at, and there are some excellent books on the subject, none of them go into the financial aspects. These were the twin towers of world commerce. The whole motive behind the attack was financial. It had everything to do with finances, and yet many books focus on the bombs and the conspiracies, rightly so. My book goes a step further, Dr. Stan, and talks about the financial centers involved, who backed up their computers and who didn't, because the firms that did not back up their computer files were bankrupted and out of business within a few months of 9/11. Some mighty big firms fell because their data was not backed up to date, and other firms who had just finished backing up their data, coincidentally, of course, managed to gobble these other firms up because they were prepared for these attacks. Not only that, I name insurance companies who made quite a lot of money off of 9/11, off the backside of 9/11. And I was fortunate, Dr. Stan, to have been 3 years into an interview with a former financial insider, a man who had traded money for governments with the biggest banks in the world, banks that we never hear about on the street, with individuals that we never hear about. I've been interviewing him for some 3 years on who's really pulling the strings on what's really manipulating ourselves, the world, the markets. And I called him up after 9/11. I said, what's your take on that? And he said to me, quote, that's a pretty good fireworks display. He was watching it on television and went, boy, they really did a good job. They've got the American public traumatized. That's perfect for mind control. And he said they're going to move a lot of money based on these attacks on 9/11 because at the financial elite, at the top of the power pyramid, he said, what is most important is movement. We must have movement. We must have wars. We must have engineered disasters, whatever it takes to keep the money moving. And as my book points out, and I detail how much money moved, who moved it, and where it went, hundreds of billions of dollars were moved as a result of 9/11 and the wars that followed. And I name names, I name companies, and I document these assertions. We go heavily into the Carlyle Group, a name many of your listeners will be familiar with. What you may not be aware of is that this group is known to insiders as the Collective. And we're talking a couple of hundred firms here that really control not only the U.S. monetary system, but the United States government, and arranges things like 9/11 for profit and power, and has done so and continues to do so. And these are some of the deeper motives behind 9/11 that my book, Day of Deception, goes into in detail.
And, of course, for our listeners out there, Carlyle Group is Frank Carlucci and James Baker III. Who is
indeed
James Baker III? He's the man who heads the Iran Study Group that's over there right now trying to figure out what we're going to do with this mess in Iraq. I should say the Iraq Study Group. So, you know, these people give incest a bad name. George Herbert Walker Bush is very big in Carlyle, as was, of course, Kissinger. In fact, originally were the Saudi princes, but they got out after 9/11.
Yes, that's exactly right.
Now,
they did. Yes.
Go right ahead.
Well, they did name a Saudi princess. You're quite right, and that's fascinating. As one of the financiers behind the 9/11 hijackers, these are allegations, we must stress. These are allegations and charges. It will never go to court, so we'll never have proof. And, of course, we have the WAMI, the little Islamic group there in Washington, D.C. And, isn't that interesting? We have Bin Laden as the head of that group, a group implicated abroad and charged with furthering terrorist attacks, financing terrorism. Of course, that particular Bin Laden and some dozens of others were flown out of the country just after the attacks when all other flights were grounded and before the FBI could ask them some very pointed questions. It's really, Dr. Stan, a very closed, incestuous circle that has set up these attacks, profited from them, and covered their tracks.
I think one of the most interesting stories is the story of course, what happened to the Morgan Stanley employees there in the South Tower, where their chief of security, Rick Scorla, was ordered not to have them leave. Now, you're talking 2,700 to 2,800 people, and he's told to keep them at their desk. The loudspeaker system is telling them to stay, don't get up and leave. Everything's fine. This building's perfectly safe. And, of course, Rick Scorla gets them out. And of course, immediately after the attack, everybody says 6,000 people died. You remember that?
I do. Well, there were many numbers, yes.
And then, of course, it turned out that, and I often wondered, did they count that 2,700 Morgan Stanley employees? Were they supposed to die that morning? Because Vescorla disobeyed the order he was given, and he got them out of the building.
Wow, I hadn't heard that particular story. That's a good story. We're pretty sure it's very hard to get a count, but we think we're around 2,900 people. And an employee contacted me by email afterwards and said that actually the buildings were mostly empty. As you're well aware, the financial traders would come to work later in the morning. Many stayed away for reasons we're not sure of, but many were legitimately not going to work until later. Many were en route to work when the attacks occurred. And when the loudspeakers told people to return to their desks, stay at their desks, there was a legitimate reason for that in that the earlier attacks the early Trade Center attacks saw a lot of heavy paned windows coming down and shattering on the pavement and hurting or killing people that had been fleeing the building. So the thought was, stay inside and don't expose yourself to these falling debris. At least that was the excuse given, and it was a pretty good excuse. The first firefighters on scene were killed by falling bodies from above. So the idea was, stay inside till we see what's going on. But those orders were never rescinded. And interestingly, people tried to make their way on the upper floors above the stricken floors to the fire exits onto the roof, and those exits were locked by a computerized system that simply failed. And when they managed to get the computer system going to open those doors, it was too late, and the doors never did open. People did not access the roof. They had two helicopters circling, but they were unable to land because of the obstructions on the roofs and a lot of radiation, actually, from the microwave antennas up there. So they probably couldn't have gotten anybody off. But there were many errors, many tragedies, and many heroes that day. My book goes in, as I said, a minute-by-minute account of people in the buildings, who got out, who didn't, and some very heroic, not just firefighters and police officers, but heroic office workers and people you mentioned in the basement who kept going back in for their comrades.
And of course, one of the most amazing things is there were so few people on those four planes. I mean, put them all together and the planes were less than a quarter of filled, all four of them. So obviously it was very, very convenient of Osama bin Laden to do this just so there wouldn't be so many people in the planes that would, of course, would die that morning.
But that doesn't make sense, does it? Because the whole modus of terrorism is to kill as many people as possible to spread terror, not to minimize casualties. You would attack the buildings later when they were full. You would use aircraft that would be, well, maybe not full. Of course, you had very few hijackers on board, and so it would be easier to commandeer an aircraft. But as you rightly noted, as my book points out, those planes were below capacity by seasonal norms. It was very unusual for that time of day, that month, for those airplanes to be so lightly loaded. We don't know if there were games being played with reservations or what, but the fact remains that two facts remain. The planes were lightly loaded, and we do not know today who the hijackers were. We know seven are still alive, so they must have been using stolen names and passports. And we don't know who the pilots were. We do know that several of the named pilots could not even fly a Cessna and land it unassisted without terrifying their instructors. We do know there were Arabs in the cockpit because we have those tapes, but we don't know who they were. We don't know who those pilots were, and we saw some spectacular aerial maneuvers that even veteran pilots say they would have trouble pulling off. And we have more questions than answers in terms of who did this. And by the way, Dr. Stan, we have another aircraft held on the runway at New York Airport. After the grounding order, several Arab gentlemen jumped up, started screaming obscenities, demanding that the plane take off. And when police were called, they somehow managed to escape the aircraft.
Isn't that amazing? I mean, I've heard that story. You would think that the least they would have done would be arrest these people for disruption and hold them.
You would think. So that was another hijacked aircraft. And then up here in Canada, one of the many airplanes diverted to this country landed, and box cutters were found on board in the seat pockets. We can, I think, rightly assume that plane was scheduled for hijacking. We know from captured videotapes and confessions of high lieutenants close to Osama bin Laden that other aircraft were designated to be hijacked that morning and flown out to targets on the West Coast. So it could have been even worse than what it was. But the grounding order, fortunately, was given soon enough to block those other flights and divert them.
Well, there are a lot of unanswered questions. Both of the investigations we've had, the Bush administration has blocked from presenting any worthwhile information. The Bush administration insisted on censoring both attacks so that Osama bin Laden would not know what we knew ahead of time. All of the important information has been sealed, employees have been threatened, and anybody like Jimmy Walters, who spent millions of his dollars of his own trying to get the truth out in New York, buying full-page advertisements on television and, of course, advertisements certainly in the newspapers. Why, of course, he's been threatened and now is hiding in Europe, at least living in Europe. And the same thing has happened to a number of people who've come forward. Now, if there's nothing to conceal, why are they concealing it? And who is doing the threatening here in America? The silence people. Will, let's get your website up right now. How can people get in touch with you?
Thank you. People can go to willthomas.net. I should have that book, Day of Deception, up within the next week. Look for it. It is the most complete and up-to-date account yet written on 9/11 with all the very latest information up through October 06.
That's willthomas.net. We'll be right back. WillThomas.net. I'll correct that when we get back. Go ahead, Will. You've got 3 minutes to wrap up the program.
I'm hoping that this book will, the documentation in this book, will allow people to make up their own minds and their own decisions on what happened at 9/11, and more importantly, what is happening to our country, to our Constitution, to the future for our children. Some of the good news is that books like this can still be published. We have videos like Loose Change and other independent video productions. Freedom and Fascism, I recommend that as well. Circulating now through the United States, just as the Samizdat VHS tapes helped to bring down the former Soviet Union, I'm hoping that we see a velvet revolution, that is a peaceful, nonviolent uprising by the people, for the people, to reclaim our country and our destiny from the real hijackers. Who are in the White House as we speak, and I think whose days are fortunately numbered. I certainly pray so. This attack, the attacks of 9/11, this false flag operation, was treasonous. We have certainly enough evidence to bring the current administration to trial, and they have a lot to answer for.
And, of course, the fact that they have simply silenced anybody who works for the government or anybody who works for the military. They've been ordered not to tell what they know. All of the documents have been sealed. And, of course, how are we ever going to get the information? If there's nothing to conceal, then I would expect the president to unseal all the documents there. The records from the 911 commission. There were over 1,000 people who testified, 1,200 people testified, probably 100 of them were heard, 1,100 testimonies sealed for 30 years. Why would you seal testimony for 30 years, Will?
Well, we don't have 30 years. We have so many dire situations converging right now. We urgently need the truth in all matters, and as important, we need direct participation of the American citizens in their own governance, in determining their own destiny. So we don't have 20, 30 years for documents to remain sealed. I would hope that impeachment proceedings would come forward fairly soon, and perhaps that might serve as a lever, or something like impeachment might serve as a lever to pry those documents. But you know, Dr. Stan, this information is available, and it's really the mainstream media that's in the way here. If they did their jobs and reported as journalists and as reporters and not as shills and propagandists and hacks
Hold that thought, Will. We're going to have to get to... Well, this is Dr. Stan. Our guest has been Will Thomas, and you can go to his website at willthomas.com, willthomas.com. One parting thought before I let you go.
Demand from your media, your local and national media, to start telling the truth on 9/11 and other current events that affect all of our lives. It is urgent. The information is available. We don't have to wait for government. We don't have to wait for anyone. And it's time for each one of us to spread that information, to network with each other, to stand up and be heard and be strong.
Amen. God bless you, and I'm looking forward to getting the book, Will. We'll get you on again as soon as you get copies out there.
Thank you. I'll make sure you get the copies as soon as they're available.
Bye-bye. Okay, that was Will Thomas. And again, if you'd like to get a copy of the book, it's willthomas.com. And Will has done a lot of great books here in the recent years. If you really want to know what happened that day, we carry a number of DVDs. We have one entitled Terror Storm. It's put out by Alex Jones. He did a good job because he covers not only what happened here on 911, he goes into the London bombing, and you'll hear what a member of the British Parliament says, a member of the British Cabinet, a former member of British intelligence about the London bombing, and it's nothing like you've been told by the controlled media here. And then he goes into the Madrid bombing. But then, of course, he gives you the coup de grace on what happened here in the United States on 911. That's Terror Storm by Alex Jones. We also carry an excellent DVD entitled 911 Press for the Truth. It's the story of the Jersey Girls, the four widows who lost their husbands when the Twin Towers came down. And it's very well done, very professionally done, and we recommend it to you. We carry a DVD put out by Dave Van Kleist entitled In Plain Sight. That's P-L-A-N-E, In Plain Sight. Very well done. And, of course, the video, 911, The Day That Changed America Forever. The first three are available in DVD. The fourth is available in video and in DVD. So if you'd like to get them, give us a call of 1-800-544-8927. Now, we have a four-tape set. It's called 911 Update. And there you'll hear my two-hour interview with Paul Thompson, who's written a very, very good timeline. And then 2 hours with Jimmy Walters, the millionaire, who literally spent almost his entire fortune running full-page ads, you know, in the New York Times and advertisements and television in New York. And you've never heard of Jimmy Walter. Well, the reason you haven't is because he's had so many death threats, and they put a big boulder on top of his car, and now he's hiding in Europe. Ladies and gentlemen, this is not imaginary. This is not a story. This is real. Michael Rupert's been driven out of the country. Certainly William Rodriguez, who was the last man out of the North Tower, who heard the explosions. He was in the sub-basement. He could feel the explosions as they rocked the building before the plane hit up above. Have you heard about William Rodriguez? We actually have an interview with William Rodriguez, and you can order that through Radio Liberty, and you'll actually hear him tell his story. That's a William Rodriguez interview. And then, of course, there were people rushing up from the lower basement. One of them, of course, it was just so badly burned. Why? A massive fire bomb explosion in the basement, timed to go off as the plane hit above, but it went off early, a few seconds early. And a number of people heard the explosions in the basement. Why haven't we heard about that? William Rodriguez testified before the 911 commission. You know what they did with his testimony? They sealed it for 30 years. Peter Lance, of course, who had a frequent guest in our program, who's written one of the books, A Thousand Years for Revenge, the most recent book, Triple Cross. He had actually had all the information on Project Bojanka. It was a plan to hijack planes and crash them into the World Trade Center of the Pentagon. They knew about that. The government had known about it for 5 years. He testified before the 911 commission. They sealed his testimony for 30 years. Pray for America. Pray for revival. Please pray for Radio Liberty, for our provision and our protection.